Well, we get to go a little bit further with this morning, and I am, again, glad to talk about an important subject. I recognize that I'm going to leave tons of holes in this process, but by tonight, by the final session tonight, if we haven't started tying those holes up, either I've done a really, really poor job or you drifted off to sleep on me. And so feel free, after it's over tonight, in fact, you can ask questions anytime you want to as far as that goes, but by tonight, I hope it becomes a bit of a package. I realize that as you kind of layer it out in pieces and portions, that you can leave some real confusion. And so if you've got some real confusion, don't feel bad. That's really there, kind of normal. If, on the other hand, you can't figure out even what the big deal on this is, okay, what's so radically saying? I don't hear anything all that much. That either means you came from a home where you rather intrinsically pick these things up and you understand them, or it means you don't understand the big question yet. And so we'll see how that one goes, too. Everybody has a system for how you understand things work. That's just innate. You have a sense of, wow, this is how things ought to be. And if they don't work the way you think they're going to, boy, you get really frustrated. Our next to the youngest grandchild is Kinley. Kinley will be 2 in June. I got tickled the other day, and she's a sweet, sweet little girl, good disposition. But she had out all of her grandmother's big cookie sheets and those sort of things that come out of that little corner cabinet in the kitchen. Many of you know that little narrow door that you open up. And Kinley had seen people move these, you know, cookie sheets and things in and out. And all you do is you pull down the door and you take the sheet and you just stick it in. And she didn't really notice that you turn them upright to stick them in. All she notices is if you just shove hard, they'll go in. And she was getting so frustrated because she was taking this large plastic one, or I would have taken it away from her probably, and she's just shoving it, and it won't go in. And, I mean, she's just frustrated. And you could see she was just getting worked up because the more she shoved, and she would turn it, and she'd push it, and she would go every which way, and it didn't work. And you're watching a little, whatever month she is, 18-month-old or whatever she is, you're watching her, and it feels to me like what I watch big people do. Because it feels like it's the young couple that I married 3 years ago or 5 years ago. And nobody wakes up at 5 o'clock in the morning and says, you know, I think I want to screw up my marriage today. Nobody says, you know, I really think I just really want to break my wife's heart or I want to break my husband's heart. Nobody thinks, you know, I think I want to get up today and just feel miserable in my chest because this isn't working well. And we just keep shoving the cookie sheet hoping it'll work today. The problem is, if you don't understand how things work, working harder at it doesn't really change anything. It just frustrates you more. That's why the three systems you have to kind of figure out. System number one, it's not just a gimmick I'm giving you. There's again, a massive group of people, 25, 30, 35%, again, it depends on what age group, who believe that the reason we love somebody, the reason I would love my wife is she just makes me love her. She's so good to me, and she just makes me happy, And things just, she's a wonderful woman, and I just can't help but love her. Well, that's really good on the front end. But what do I do when I wake up and I just don't love her like I wished I did? I wished I did. I want to. But she doesn't make me want to love her like that much anymore. She doesn't draw my love like she used to. What's wrong with that woman? Boy, if she were just skinnier, prettier, sexier, and all kinds of stupid stuff starts in your head. Girls, the same stories work the flip side. In fact, massive numbers of affairs. I'm so sick and tired of affairs. I deal with affairs constantly. Massive number of affairs come out of this belief that you can't help but love someone. They draw your love. I'll love you if you make me love you. Well, what happens when he doesn't make you love you anymore, but you work with him and he does. What do you do then? Well, I married the wrong one. I'm stuck with you, but you're the one who works for me now. There's not a woman in this room who would say, boy, I want to grow up and have an affair. But what do you do in your system when it breaks and doesn't work and you can't just keep shoving the cookie sheet? The first one is Eros. I'll love you if you meet my needs. Well, good luck. Nobody can do that. As long as you're my drug of choice, I'll love you. I mean, basically, it doesn't work. Okay. The second one is I'll love you. I love you because. And it basically has to do with the idea that as long as you're what I like, and as long as you're what I like, and as long as the chemistry works, it will not work more than 5 date years. Trust me, it will not work. It's been said by philosophers and poets, and so it may not make any sense to you, but you can't fall in love with a river. And you understand that. You can't fall in love with a river because whatever a river is, it just moved. And whatever was there is not there now. It is now moved downstream. Literally, we are learning to love someone who's in the middle of massive transition and will be their entire life. I married Julie when she was a 20-year-old girl. Wonderful, sweet 20-year-old girl. But I'm married to a woman in her mid-50s now. That woman who's in her mid-50s is incredibly different than that 20-year-old girl I married. Very, very different. I can tell you I love her far more and deeper now than I did then. But how? How? Can't be this one. Because there's a lot of traits that Julie has that, quite frankly, I probably would have wanted to run from if I thought I was being married in my 50s to a woman who's these kinds of traits, these kinds of personality things, these kinds. But I told you that she would feel the same way about me. So how do you do it? It's not these two. We have about 55 minutes. And I know many of you didn't get a lot of sleep last night, and so I apologize. I'll do what I can to help it. But this is what you want. You want this one. Cash all your chips in. Walk out of the place until they give you this one. This is the one you want. Okay? This one, by the way, the one about having a box and you date somebody with a box, that's perfectly fine for dating. In fact, you need a box for dating. If you didn't have a box for dating on who you would date because of characteristics, you would have dated some pretty weird characters, okay? I'm telling you, this is perfectly fine. In fact, tonight's session in particular is I'm going to tell you, and we're going to talk about it, on how do you figure out who should be in your box and how do you figure out what your own box is. And so that's tonight. Tonight we'll put that together. This one is perfectly fine for dating. You need it. But you're not ready to move from dating to this one until you have a radical shift in how you think and understand. The Greek word eros is the one down here. I'll love you if you meet my needs, if you'll stay sexy, if you always stay funny, if I always like waking up in the morning and looking at you, and those sort of things. This one down here is I love you because. It's Philos. This one is the Greek word that many of you know. You've heard it in church your entire life. I want you to just hang in here for about 5 to 6 minutes while I give you some medicine. It won't be too entertaining. It's just the straight medicine. If you'll work really hard for 5 or 6 minutes, we'll get to a little bit more entertaining portion and a little bit more practical portion here in a second. But I got to give you the medicine first, okay? So stick with me. It's the Greek word agape. Whenever God calls you into a marriage relationship, the word that he uses is the word agape. He doesn't use eros. He doesn't use philos. He uses agape. Now, agape is an interesting Greek word. It has almost zero concept of emotion. It has almost no sense of something that you feel. If you were to say in the Greek language, you know, I really agape peaches or something, the idea, wow, I just love peaches, the taste of them sort of thing, and you use the word agape, they would look at you really funny and go, what? What do you do to peaches? I mean, honestly, because because the word agape has almost nothing to do with emotion. It has almost nothing to do with how you feel. It's a word that's almost exclusively related to behavior. The word agape is a behavior word. It's a word that is tied less to your heart and your affection and tied very strongly to your backbone. Now, think for a second. When you say someone operates, wow, that person must have a lot of backbone or must have a lot of courage or must have a lot of honor or must have a lot of character trait kind of things, you can associate the idea of agape with that. I try to think of phrases that you would use it with, but let me just walk through Scripture where it is a little bit. The Greek Old Testament, called the Septuagint, it's where they took the Hebrew Old Testament and put it in Greek, they used the word agape for God's consistent treatment of Israel. And so the text might say in the prophets that God's wrath and anger burned against Israel, yet God loved Israel. It's the word agape. The question, how did God feel toward Israel? Well, he felt wrath and anger. What was his behavior? His behavior was he did what was loving. It's the word that's used in Matthew chapter 5 for Christians, love your enemies. You say, but I don't like my enemy. God says, yeah, I understand that. That's the reason he's your enemy. But the point I would say, he says in Scripture, is I want you to love your enemy. Well, what do you mean? I don't feel pleasant toward my enemy. I know that. Let me use the word agape. It's a behavior word. It means I want you to reach into your character, and I want you to pull out what's required out of your character to see that if your enemy's hungry, I want you to feed him. If your enemy's thirsty, I want you to give him drink. I want you to give just the milk of human kindness to your enemy. I want you to treat your enemy this way. It's a word that means behavior. It's the word that's used in Ephesians 5 for husbands love your wives. It is not the Valentine's word. It's the backbone word. I realize it's a little hard to help this paradigm sort of shift for people, but there's a football coach that I had back when I was a sophomore in high school that, I mean, it's like he was straight out of a casting crew for a movie. I mean, I had a couple of coaches through years that were kind of that way, but this one by far is the most stereotypical coach I ever saw in my life. That buzz flat top he had, that walk that he had. I mean, I'm telling you, this coach was playing a role. I mean, he had to be. The thing I remember in particular was we had two-day practices like everybody has for football. And you start August, and back in our day, it was August 8th you started. In the first day of practice, we ran the first 2.5 hours that morning, regular practice like you always do. We got done, we ran the sprints at the end, and we thought, wow, we're pretty tired. And we're headed back in because you got to at least shower and clean up so you can come back for the 5:30 second practice that day. As we left the practice field, we crossed the track of the school, and he said, okay, stop here. Everybody go down to the far end. Practice is over. No, it's not. And he lined us up, and he had us run 100-yard sprints on the track. We ran 23 100-yard sprints when practice was over. We ran 23 100-yard sprints, and the entire time he's on a bullhorn, a red bullhorn. To this day, I still see him. And he kept saying this phrase over and over. There are guys throw it up. There are guys that don't want to run. There's guys who don't think they can run. He keeps using this phrase over and over. It's a phrase that goes, gut it out, gut it out, gut it out. I bet he said gut it out 7 jillion times. Gut it out. You don't want to do this from your heart. You don't want to do this even from your head. You don't think you can do this. I want you to reach in your backbone, out of your character, your will. I want you to do this. Gut it out. And so we ran wind sprints. If you don't mind me borrowing a rather sloppy word, it's pretty close. Everywhere you find the word agape in Scripture, the phrase gutted out fits perfect. It fits perfect. For example, in the prophets, God's wrath and anger burned against Israel, but God gutted it out with Israel. Christians in Matthew chapter 5, gutted out with your enemies. If your enemy's hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him drink. John 3:16, for God so gutted it out with the world, he gave his only begotten Son. Well, have you read the episode in the Garden of Gethsemane where Jesus is praying, Father, if it's possible, let this cup pass from me. What's Jesus saying? Father, I don't want to go to the cross with my emotions. I'm not even sure. I mean, you just, with all of the physical things that Jesus would be going through in the humanity, going, I'm not even sure how I'll handle the cross. Father, if it be possible, take this cup from me. But nevertheless, not my will, but your will be done. And from his will, he got up from the Garden of Gethsemane and met his accusers and went to the cross. For God so gutted it out with the world. Now, here's the problem. Here's the problem. It's also the word in Matthew 5. I mean, in Ephesians 5. Husbands, gut it out with your wives. Boy, that's the husband you want, isn't it? I'm telling you, boy, he's a real keeper. I've done close to 700-800 weddings now. I don't have any idea what I've done. I stopped counting a long, long time ago, but 600-700. My wife says I exaggerate sometimes, so somewhere between 600 and 700. Nobody has ever said to me, Randy, would you be sure in our wedding say, you know, Sean, do you promise to gut it out with, you know, Elaine? And Elaine, do you promise to cut? Nobody wants that. Nobody ever says that. But the truth is, you don't have a snowball's chance in hell of having a really good marriage unless you understand what it means to gut it out with for a lifetime relationship. Doesn't that sound like slavery? I mean, doesn't that just sound like gritting your teeth and becoming a slave to somebody to gut it out with? Wow. Why would someone want to have that kind of, wow, I want you to know, you know, Sean, we've been married these 7 years, and I want you to know it's been my duty to love you every day. I've gritted my teeth and made myself do it. I want you to know I've got up every morning, and not from my heart because I wanted to, but just because I knew I ought to. I've got up and loved you every day, and our marriage has been wonderful. It's what I always hoped. You know, who would want that? Doesn't this sound just almost stupid? But I need to tell you with all integrity, if a meteorite hit me right now, I've told you God's will for marriage. I've told you exactly God's will for marriage. That when you sign on to a lifetime relationship in the presence of God, if you want the marriage God intends, it's not going to come out of, I'll love you if you meet my needs. It won't come out of, I'll love you because you're what I like. You see, the word agape is not only the idea that I will love you with right actions, but it even has the implication of I will love you with right actions even in the middle of difficult circumstances. I will love you even when it's hard. Can I tell you the sweetest thing, and this will get pretty tender for me. I have to watch my own lip not to bounce too much. My daughter Katie is one of the more phenomenal individuals I've ever met. Katie is a tremendous blessing. She's our middle child. Katie has had terrible postpartum depression on this second child. Came out of the blue. I mean, it hit her hard. She has been almost in a fetal position on the couch, just shaking so hard, going, Mom and Dad. But her husband, Josh, am I going crazy? Am I going crazy? What's wrong with me? Are my kids, Kenley and Hunter, are they going to be raised by a psycho mom? What's going on? And she's just shaking so violently. She is so discouraged. That's the reason I was holding Julie earlier this week in a hallway outside our bedroom. And my wife's just shaking, going, I don't know how to help her. I don't know how to help her through this. This is so hard. Don't you put any romance in the middle of this, because it's really, really hard when someone has cried where they can't cry anymore, where someone is just so defeated in how they feel. And Josh, our son-in-law, who is a great guy, loves my daughter with, I am so proud of Josh. He loves her. Not if she meets his needs. He doesn't love her because of what she is at this glorious box that she's in at the moment. He loves her out of his backbone and his courage and his will. And she's doing so much better. Yesterday, she kept her kids by herself for the first time in about a week and a half. And she said, she called me yesterday. She said, Dad, I'm coming out of the fog. She said, man, it's deep in here. She said, I've never had anything like this. I couldn't ever imagine this ever happening to me. I sort of say to you gals, bless your heart, you're tough birds. Before creation, God lined up all of humanity before creation and said, all the wimps over here, all the non-wimps over here. And I think all the non-wimps, I think he called you women. And I mean, you have the babies and you have the hormonal things that bounce back and forth. And you have, I mean, I am so proud of you gals. Bless your hearts. And all you wimps are the guys. I'm just telling you that right now. We'll have them have the babies, you know, and those sort of things. But my son-in-law, Josh, loves her out of the what? Out of the courage, out of the backbone. Now, okay, there's the medicine. There's the medicine. Now, you're still sitting here going, but that's not the kind of marriage I want. I want a husband or I want a wife who really does love me, who it's not just slavery in a ring and forced to do it. And I mean, I want Valentine's Day to really happen in our marriage. And there's a neat, neat, wonderful secret. There is a neat, wonderful twinkle in God's eye. God has neat surprises for those who will go down. A lot of paths the Lord asks you to walk down in your life will look really hard at the front of that path. But in the middle of that path, you will find God has incredible surprises on that road. And the reason people don't experience some of the great blessings of God is you didn't trust Him enough to go down the road that looked hard. And it was in that hard road that the best blessings came. Here's one of them. God so designed, and here's a principle about human life. Comes from Matthew chapter 6. Where your investment is, there will your heart be also. Now, you normally hear that related to offerings at church. But it's a principle about how God wired us. You want to know how the human heart works? Do you want to know how you have affection for anything or anyone? The answer is, where your investment is, there will your heart be also. Let me just use, and I use the same kind of silly illustrations all the time. Sean, am I reading your name right? Let me pick on Sean. Without my glasses on, I can't read anything. Your name could have been Samantha as far as I can't. Don't get old. You can't hear and you can't see. I mean, those are two things that take place. Let me pick on Sean. For my illustration, Sean lives in a little apartment there off the edge of town, drives back and forth to college. And Sean has this mongrel mangy dog that showed up in his neighborhood. This dog is hanging around on the front steps of his apartment. This dog has all its hair fallen out. I mean, it's in bad shape. This dog is not cuddly. It's not fun. There's nothing good about this dog. It just gives him the weebie-jeebies. This dog hangs around. And for a couple of 3 days, Sean's been trying to drive the dog off, throwing rocks at it and just saying, get out of here, and you know, all those sort of things, trying to get that dog to go somewhere else. But the dog won't go somewhere else. So what's Sean finally do? Because, I mean, he didn't care for the dog. What's he finally do to get rid of the dog? Well, the answer is he goes in and picks up the phone and calls the animal control officer. And he says, say, I've got this dog. Would you come pick it up? Now, we all know what that means. It's probably not going to get adopted. It's probably going to be put down. Now, he didn't automatically assign that blame to himself, but he still goes, animal control officer needs to come get it. So Sean makes the phone call. They say, Mr. Sean, be happy to do so. Want you to know, be glad to do so. But we got a man on vacation. Truck broke down. It'll be a couple, 3 days before we can get there. But it's settled. Now, he's waiting for them to come get this dog, and the dog still hangs around. Now, Sean has enough humanity. Look at him. You can tell he's a compassionate guy. I mean, he has enough humanity that nothing should starve to death. He's not been feeding it before, because if you feed it, it'll stay around. But now he doesn't really care if it stays around, because he's going to come pick it up. So what's he do with scraps off the table tonight? He goes over the fence and, here, you stupid dog, if you want this. And so he feeds it, and the dog comes and eats it. And then it's one of those cold Illinois ice storms comes through. And, I mean, it's blowing rain and freezing. And that dog's laid out underneath a bush. And he feels bad. So they've kind of got this old maintenance shed there at the apartments. And so what's Sean do? Well, nothing should freeze under that under a lilac bush. So he goes and throws open the door to the maintenance shed. And so the dog gets in and he says, there, you stupid dog, if you went out of the, you know, the ice in the storm, you know, I mean, you can get in here where there's some straw at least. And he does that. And he feeds it again, and he feeds it again. And sure enough, the animal control officer comes on Thursday when he called on Monday, but it's too late by then. Why? Because Sean has already caught the dog, taken it to the vet, spent $211 on it. And Sean now owns the dog. Not only does Sean own the dog, but Sean has a great affection for the dog. And when the dog dies 3 years later of something else, Sean cries like a baby. Why? Because he has an affection. Now, let me ask you, on Saturday of last week when he was throwing rocks at it and trying to get it to leave, and on Thursday of this week and he takes it to the vet, did the dog change? The answer, the dog didn't change at all. What changed? His behavior changed. Jesus' principle is, where your investment is, there will your heart be also. We pick on you two girls, Kim and... Oh, so you're also under an alias. Okay, come up here, Ashley. And I'm just being a touch ornery with Ashley, who goes by Matea, and Kim. I'm a simple little story. Many of you have heard me tell this before in the past, but I'm going to, by some magic wand, poof, I'm going to make them both sixth grade girls. Okay? So they're both sixth grade girls, and I give both girls, you get a gerbil and you get a gerbil. Now, neither one wanted a rodent, but I gave them to them anyhow. Okay? Now, here's my story, and I'm going to tell my story the way I want to, and you've got to live with the consequences. You need to know that Kim is a very self-disciplined. She is able to live a very meticulous life. She lives with order in her life. She doesn't like the gerbil. But I gave her instructions. I want you to feed it every day, water it every day, clean its cage once a week, take it for a walk, those sort of things. I mean, I gave her instructions, okay? And Kim is very self-disciplined, and she does all those things. Can't stand the stupid gerbil, but she feeds it, she waters it, she does all those sort of things. Ashley, my apologies, dear, but Ashley's a slob. I mean, you need to know that, okay? Ashley is the individual who just sort of gets through life, and she doesn't have much self-discipline, and she's pretty immature for a sixth grade girl we're talking about here. And so Ashley, she doesn't like the gerbil either. She doesn't like it either. So feeding it becomes an adventure. In fact, her mother, the regular routine, almost every evening, is her mother says, Ashley, did you feed the gerbil today? Ashley says, no, Mom, I didn't feed the gerbil. Her mom says to her, I know you didn't feed the gerbil. I fed the gerbil again. You're being irresponsible. And then her mom turns to her and says this classic line, do you know how many times that gerbil would have died if I hadn't fed it? Ashley's answer is, once, Mom, it would have died once. But that's a really bad line to use at that moment, okay? I mean, it doesn't fit well. So anyhow, now, by, again, some magic wand, 3 months into this deal, both gerbils die. Same day. I don't know. It's genetics. I have no idea. It's my story. And so both gerbils die the same day. Tell me what the response is in two girls. It's pretty funny. It's pretty different. You see, Kim writes in a journal that day as a sixth grade girl. She writes, I'm pretty surprised, but I cried for a gerbil today. And she begins to realize a deeper affection than she had ever really grasped, and she honestly cared for that stupid thing. You need to know that Ashley is so relieved. Bless her. I mean, on the one hand, she feels guilty, and there's a guilt feeling she has. But on the other hand, that stupid thing being gone, it's got her in more trouble. It's been more pain. Now, the two girls get together and get to talking about it, and she acts as if she really misses her gerbil. And she says to her, "You must have got a more cuddly, cute gerbil than I had, because mine wasn't all that lovable." And that's true. Is the difference the gerbil? Of course not. The difference is a basic biblical principle that God hardwired in you. Where your investment is, there will your heart be also. You can sit down. You're just glad you weren't called up here and had to stand here. Why do mamas love their babies? Well, you say it's easy. Mamas just naturally, automatically love their babies. Oh, really? Oh, really? I can tell you all kinds of stories. One of the first ones I remember, it's from years and years ago, but it was one of the first ones that blew me out of the water. She was a little old gal that was from Webb City. She was 16. She had her baby. And I remember her family just panicking like crazy because she didn't really end up loving her baby. I'll tell you why in a second. Why do mamas love their babies? Well, the answer normally is this. A little girl even carries the dreams and aspirations and hopes of a baby oftentimes long, long, long before that baby ever has conception. A mama carries that baby for 9 months in her stomach. She throws up for 3 months of it every morning or afternoon and every smell of salami. She goes to the doctor and spends buku bucks at the doctor. She goes through every humiliating examination they can make on the face of the earth for the sake of this baby. She typically goes home and she paints a room. And she goes to every garage sale that she can within 70 miles and finds little dealy daubers to hang from the ceilings and little things. And she's getting ready for this baby. She goes through labor. My wife went through 24 hours on her first one of hard, hard labor. And she comes out with this little wrinkly, ugly little thing. I love my kids. Don't misunderstand me. But they're not exactly the most gorgeous things when they hit the world. And they don't have much talent. I mean, there's really not much they can do. And you take them home, and they're colicky, and they'll cry a lot. You're up in the middle of the night walking babies up and down hallways. But why did my wife love her baby? Because the answer is so hardwired that where your investment is, there will your heart will be. And what you pour your life into, your affections follow. You know why the little 16-year-old girl in Webb City didn't love her baby, don't you? And the answer is not because she was a lousy, horrible person. The answer is she was a 16-year-old girl who for some reason just didn't get very sick in her pregnancy. She was a 16-year-old girl whose body didn't make her all that uncomfortable in her pregnancy. Even if she wanted to paint the little nursery that they were doing for this baby, her mother, who she lived with, her grandmother said, "Oh, sweetheart, don't you be in here smelling those fumes, and you get out of here and let me paint that nursery." And so Grandma painted the nursery. And who do you think paid for all the doctor's bills at the doctor? Do you think 16-year-old girl or her mother paid for it? Well, her mother paid for it, and so Grandma pays, and so Grandma's the one who's making sure that the doctor's paid. Who do you think went to all the garage sales and got all the little dealy daubers to hang from the ceiling? The answer is Grandma did. And when the little old girl had the baby, sure enough, and I'm tickled and pleased she had that baby, because there's other options, I know, and I'm so pleased she had the baby. But even there, Grandma took the doctor aside and said, "Look, now, she's 16. Don't you let her go through much pain. You coddle her." And so they did. And so she didn't have much pain in the baby. They pretty medicated up. And the baby comes home. The baby's colicky, needs to be walked every night. Who do you think walks the baby? Grandma says to her daughter, "Sweetheart, you go get some sleep, hon. You're exhausted. You get some sleep. I'll walk this baby." So Grandma walks the baby. And when the baby's sick, who looks after the baby? And when the baby's throwing fits, who looks after the baby? Now you tell me 6 months later why a family comes in, just can't hardly believe it, and saying, "My daughter doesn't hardly love her own baby." Who loves the baby? Because where the investment is, the heart will be also. Now, I can take this a lot of places, but let me just start with one. Do you want to know why some of you have such little heart affection for one of your parents? Well, yeah, if you knew everything they'd done to me, if you knew it all. Oh, don't misunderstand me. I understand things have to be dealt with, but you want to know why you may not have a great heart and affection for a parent. Yeah, they didn't draw my love well enough. If they just drew my love, well, they could make me grow up. That isn't it. Well, yeah, they're just not, if you knew who they were, they're not the kind of person I'm automatically drawn. You don't understand. You want to know why some of you don't love your brother very much. My brother and I are just kind of two ships that pass in the dark. And I mean, I know I should have an affection and there's something kind of deep that I really would like to love him, but I don't really love my brother. Without a deep investment, there is no love. Affection comes out of deep investment. And investment doesn't come automatic. It's not magnetically pulled by another person. Investment is when you reach into your backbone and your character and you grit your teeth and you do what's right and affection follows. I got in the ministry long, long, long before I was old enough and mature enough to do it. I was the average age of you guys. I was somebody's minister, preaching at churches and those things. I graduated at age 21 from college and went to Walker, Missouri for my first ministry. It was a rural community. My wife and I tried to go to New Zealand as missionaries. There were 50-some churches without preachers, and I was going to go over and take a little circuit of three churches in New Zealand. My kids really regret that we didn't. They said, we could add a cool accent. But we were denied the work visas at the last minute. So I took a little rural church in Missouri. It's a true story. I got in over my head in marriage counseling the day I started unloading stuff at the place. In fact, we moved into, there was no housing at Walker. We moved into a senior citizens duplex center. There was no housing. My wife was the first pregnant resident. We moved in, and there's a guy that knocks on the door, and he is in a military uniform, and he says, how do you do? He says, I'm so-and-so. I attend your congregation. Glad you're here. And then he said, do you mind if we talk? And we stepped off behind an old shed over there, and he just leaned against it, this guy in military uniform, and he just started bawling. He just started bawling. He said, I'm so sorry. He said, I didn't mean to do this. I didn't intend to do this. He said, we have two little kids. The oldest one's about first grade. He said, my wife told me last night she didn't love me. My wife told me, hey, she hadn't loved me for a long time. My wife. And he just bawling. He said, can you visit with the two of us? Now, again, I mean, literally, I'm you guys' age. I went to an empty office the next day, set up at the church, and I set up three metal folding chairs, and I'm visiting with a couple. And she comes in, and she goes, you're right. I don't love him. I haven't loved him a long time. I think it was a mistake to get married, but I'm willing to stay with him for the sake of the kids, and I'm even willing to have some sex with him because we're married, but I don't love him. And he just needs to get over it. And one of these days, when the kids don't need us together quite as much, I am going to divorce him. What do you say? I knew what to say to her if she said, I'm going to divorce him now. Don't. But what do you say when someone says, I don't love someone? What do you say? I didn't know. And I began to get a series of those. I was up to my eyebrows in bad marriages in the blink of an eye. And I'm a 21-year-old kid looking at people going, I don't know how to tell you how to be in love. I mean, I know how to tell you not to divorce, but I don't know how to tell you how to be in love. I owe most of my counseling money. I've got a master's degree now, and it's got all kinds of stuff behind it and all that. But I owe most of my counseling background to one old woman in town, and I should pay her more than I've ever paid anybody else. I love my other classes, but this gal turned the light on for me. I'd been in a little town about 3, 4, 5 months. Lose track of time now, about 3 months probably. And I went and called on an old woman who was a widow in town. Her husband had died before I got to town. I didn't meet him, but I went and called on her, and she was sharp, intelligent, articulate. She was quite a gal. She was an old woman who I'm sitting there drinking tea with across from a coffee table, and I'm just doing widow calling, which is what preachers do sometimes. And we're sitting there, and she's talking about this husband who passed away in such affectionate terms. She's going, oh, I wish you could have known him, and you'd have liked him, and he'd have sure liked you. And she's a grieving widow who loved her husband. And I was a desperate kid, and I took a gamble that day that could have backfired on me, and it didn't. You see, the thing in the running back of my mind was, how did you love him? I'd already heard about him. I heard he was a jerk. I'd heard that almost nobody in the community liked him. I heard that he was a royal pain in the neck, and here is this gal talking about her husband in such kind and sweet and honest terms of her affection. And so what I did that day was I said to her, I said, I realize I could offend you here if I'm not careful, but here is the story that I have to ask. How did you love him? I'm in marriage counseling with my head. I don't know how to tell people how to love their partners, how to fall in love. But you obviously love somebody who wasn't easy to love. Do you mind telling me how you did it? She reached across the table. She took my hand. She patted my hand and said, oh, sweetie. Oh, sweetie. I was a sweetie back then. I want you to know that. She said, I would love to tell you my story. She said, I was beginning to be a bit of an old maid, and I was still single. And she said, I began to have a sense of desperation that kind of was taking place, that I'm going to end up being an old maid my whole life. Does that sound like anything? Eros, Eros, Eros. I was beginning to have a sense of need. And she said, and this guy waltzed into my life, and he began to love me, and he began to pay attention to me, and he was so kind to me, and I was good for him. And she said, I knew he drank, but she said he didn't drink when he's around me, and he stopped drinking, in fact, because I was dating him. And she said, I was beginning to rescue him, and I was good for him, and he was good for me. Eros, Eros, you hear the bells going off? Said, my mom's going, don't you date that guy. He's not. But she said, we were in love. She said, we got married. And she said, everything was wonderful for 3, 4, 5, 6 months. I lose track of how she told the story now. It's been too many years. But she said, we were in love and had a wonderful marriage for a while. And then she said, everything fell apart. She said, then suddenly he went back to the drinking a little bit and the deception and hiding his drinking from me. And then she said all the other personality traits that were there began to come out. And she said, I went from a woman who loved her husband to a year later, I can tell you, I was living with a man that I hate. I cannot stand him. She said, my own heart is tore out because this man's not capable of loving me. This man's not able to take care of me. She said, I can't have any children because if I do, this drunk would be the father. She said, my whole world collapsed. She said, I feel like I'm the laughing stock in front of a whole community. My mother's saying, I told you so. She said, I'm sitting on Sunday mornings at church. She said, I didn't attend church when we got married, but I'm sitting in church on Sunday mornings and I'm daydreaming about how I'm going to divorce the guy and how am I going to live and how am I going to support myself. And she said, I got this problem because I'm looking at the very stage where I said, till death do us part. A few months before, or year and a half before. And now I'm sitting there going, how do I get away from this guy? And she said, you can move from loving somebody to hating them very, very easily. Now, I don't necessarily recommend what she did, but the principle is still right. She said, I felt guilty one Sunday morning that I was plotting my divorce. And so she said, I went home from church, and she said, I sat out the kitchen table, and I said, God, I don't like the kind of wife I've become either. And I want to divorce him when I have a little more clean conscience. clear conscience for the kind of wife I've been. She said, I was just trying to survive. She said, it's really, really hard to survive with a guy like that. But she said, I sat at the kitchen table. She said, I wrote out 40 things that a good wife would do for a husband if she did love him. Things like fix meals when he's sober enough to eat them. Things like let him touch you again. Things like notes in his lunchbox when he goes to work. Things like, and she said, I just wrote out a list of 40 things a good wife would do for a husband. And she said, there's a pretty detestable list. She said, I gritted my teeth. She said, I prayed this prayer to God. God, I'm going to do these things for the next 3 months. And she said, God, at the end of that 3 months, if he hadn't changed, I'll have a clear conscience. I can divorce him with a clear conscience. And she said, I gritted my teeth. And for the next 3 months, she said, I just did what I had to do and what was right. She said, at the end of 3 months, everything had changed. She said, he still was who he was. But she said, I was shocked. I had an affection. I cared. And she said, thoughts and feelings came I could have never dreamed. Thoughts and feelings like, if this man's going to spend eternity in hell, he at least deserves to be loved in this lifetime. Everybody deserves to be loved. It was things like, if I can't love him, who is going to? And she said, it wasn't just pity. She said, I'm telling you, genuine affection. I began to care. She said, now don't misunderstand me. Being married to a man like him was hard, but I cared. She went ahead and finished it this way. She said, you'll probably need to know that I wouldn't trade my marriage for most anybody's in this entire community. She said, most women learn how to live with their husbands. I learned how to love mine. She said, now, I don't want to tell you being married to him was easy. She said, for the first 4, 5, 6 years, and again, I lose track of her exact details on this. For the first 4, 5, 6 years, she said, I had to get my list out regularly and grit my teeth and just keep working at it. But she said, every time I kept my investment in, my great deep affection and love for him would come. And then she said, about 4, 5, 6 years into it, she said, he looked up one morning and realized I was having a better marriage than he was. And she said, he turned to me and she said, he began for the first time to ask, how can you love me? How can you love me? And she said, and he began to figure it out. And she said, we had a sweet marriage. And she said, the rest of our marriage, we really did love each other. And we really did have a wonderful home. She said, he didn't learn how to do that very well with other people. And she said, I always regret that. And then here's where she went back and took my hand across the table. And she patted it. And she said, sweetie, you tell those couples you're working with their being in love doesn't have much to do on who they're married to. It has almost everything to do on how they treat who they're married to. I will tell you that's entirely true. Here's the normal sequence. They get married. He does 20 things for her, and I'm speaking metaphorically. He does 20 things for her, and she does 20 things for him. And they're deeply in love. But he begins to get distracted, and he drops down, and he isn't doing the 20 things anymore. And she kind of hangs for a while, but she gets her feelings hurt, and she begins to cry a little bit. And he doesn't seem to even care and get it. And so she kind of gets even. And he kind of gets his feelings hurt, and she begins to get more involved with her family, with her friends and stuff, and so he kind of begins to get even, and then she gets even, and then he gets even, and then she gets even, and they just over a series of months and maybe years just walk it down. And so it ends up that he's doing 4 things for her and she's doing 6 things for him. And she comes to my office and she says, Randy, I just don't love him anymore. Randy, our marriage is in trouble. Randy, he doesn't love me anymore. But Randy, I don't want a divorce. Randy, if you could just, I don't want to raise our 2 little boys as a single mom. If you could just get him back like he used to be, I could probably love him again. If you could just get him back like he used to be. But Randy, we're headed to a divorce. Remember, now she's doing 6 things for him and he's doing 4 things for her. So I would run across town to the welding shop and I would grab him by the lapels of his jacket. I'm going to go, look, wake up. You're going to lose the two little boys. You're going to lose her. What's going on? And you just begin to talk about, do you know what's happened? And the guy would wake up. And the guy would go, I don't want to lose. I really don't. And you would talk he would throw himself back in and he would start doing the 20 things for her. He would throw himself back in. I don't want to lose my wife and my kids. And I would go home to my wife and say, saved another marriage today. Liar, I didn't. Do you know what always happened? I guarantee you what always happened. He would throw himself back in with the 20 things, and she would come. By the way, I'm still working with them, but she would come back to me about a week and a half later, and she would say, back him off. He's driving me crazy. And then she would say these things. Like, if he'd have done this a year and a half ago, it might have made a difference. But I realize my emotions and my feelings for him are dead. My feelings are dead. They're just not there. I thought if he would try hard, my feelings would come back. But my feelings haven't come back, and I would lose her. Why? Why? Because you're not in love with the person who's doing 20 things for you. Your heart is not tied to their behavior. Your heart is tied to your behavior. And here's the big mistake I made back in those days. You come to me now and you tell me you do 6 things for him and he does 4 things for you. I will say, I'm so sorry. You're in a painful situation. But let's start with where we are. Can we start? And I will try to help you understand about your own heart and your own investment, and you pour it back in, because it's the only way I can save her heart. Her heart is not connected to his 20. It's connected to her 20. And when that occurs, then you can grab the guy and he invests it back and they go old and sweet together and they hold hands and they tell about this terrible chapter in their life that they are so glad they grew out of. But where your investment is, there will your heart be also. I am married to one of the prettiest, funniest, most emotionally balanced, joyful women, creative. I'm married over my head. But I can tell you, even in my own marriage, I know a snapshot of this, just a little. I would have never divorced my wife. I would have never left her. Don't ever see that kind of a crisis. But I can tell you a bit of a crisis of the heart. We've been married maybe 5 years. And I just remember thinking our marriage is pretty flat. We have a couple of little kids around there. And Julie's occupied with a lot of stuff. And I remember just thinking at the time, boy, marriage should have more life or energy than this. I wish Julie would get it more. We think everything. You think sexual. You think everything under the sun. It's not just that, but you'll think of lots of stuff. And I remember going, boy, I just wish Julie got it a little bit more. So our marriage had a little more of something that captured my own heart. Physician, heal thyself. You see, the truth was, I came to realize one morning, my wife was getting too many scraps from me and not enough genuine, consistent investment. And I don't think Julie changed an ounce, but I just began to stop giving my wife scraps and I reinvested. And do you know what occurred? She got prettier. She got funnier. She got more entertaining. She got more interesting. I loved her deeper. Why? Because where your investment is, that's where your heart will be. Let me say it again. Do you want to know why you don't really love very well that brother? You cannot love somebody without investment. Oh, I understand people sometimes set barriers and won't let you make investment. I understand that, and there's complicating issues. We'll talk about some of those tonight. But I'm going to tell you, you want to go home and love some parents? It has nothing to do with their magnetic personality. Do you know how to invest? You say, well, doesn't my partner have anything to do on how I feel toward them? Is it all about me? Well, no. They play a role too. It's just less than you think. What's in the Baptist camp right over here? And some of you are staying over there. If the wind is really, really hard out of the northeast, it's blowing really, really hard, and I say to you, I say to Sean here, I want you to walk back over to the Baptist camp. And he comes back into me and says, I tried to walk, but the wind was really hard in my face, and I couldn't do it. I'm going to go, Sean, you wimp. You know, good grief. It's not easy. You may have to bend over, grit your teeth, bow your neck, but you, I mean, it's going to be hard work, but you can walk over there. Don't tell me it's blowing too hard for you to go. On the other hand, if the wind's blowing hard out of the southwest, and I say, would you walk over there? It's a cakewalk for him. I mean, it almost shoves him. I mean, he didn't even realize it's hardly work at all. In my marriage, I can either make it to be where I'm the wind in my wife's face, making it very hard for her to invest in me, or I can be the wind at her back, sort of making it easy for her to invest in me. But whether my wife really loves me or not has to do on whether or not she invests. Any married couple in this room who would walk up to me and say, Randy, I just don't feel as much in love with my husband or wife as I wished I did. All you have told me is whether your investment has been in or out. That's all you've told me. Now, this is really key that we pick up. Don't you run ahead of me. Tonight's session fills in a massive hole you have to have. Don't try to put too much stuff together till we go through tonight's session. Tonight's really, really key. I don't like our American system of dating at all. The American system of dating, basically what it does is it puts two people together who automatically, by just doing the dating, will begin to care for one another. Who just doing the little investment will begin to fall in love. The problem is you don't know if there's enough character there to actually live it out. And I mean, there's all kinds of complications we'll talk about tonight. You'll fall in love with very easily somebody. And then what happens is because you have high emotions, you go home and say, okay, I have high emotions for them, so I'm going to treat them right. So you're going to have high treatment because I have high emotions. The problem is when you get home, those emotions are going to go back down to where they really are. And so what happens to high treatment? It goes down too because you don't know a system to grab a hold of. And the next thing you know, it just all falls apart. I hate this system. I've spent a lot of time in Southeast Asia, and I'll finish with this, about 5 minutes if you'll hang in here. Laos, in particular, is a country between Thailand and Vietnam. It's close to the gospel that we have a major missions work there, and I'm there a lot. Let me just talk to you about Southeast Asia. Southeast Asia has this weird, really weird deal on marriages called match marriages. Oh, who'd want match marriages? It has to be terrible to have match marriages. Well, the funny thing is we have over 80% failure rate in marriages in the sense of having a happy marriage or having a divorce, those that to put together. Theirs is actually reversed from that. They have over 80%. All sociologists will tell you over 80% of them say we have the kind of marriage we want our children to have. It's joyful. You say, well, they're just too backwards. They know they're miserable. No, good grief. I mean, no. How do they have great marriages? And I'm going to be a bit flippant on this. I understand this. But a little 6-year-old boy and a little 6-year-old girl are pledged to each other to be married in about 10 to 18 years. They're pledged to each other. They're pledged because they are in love? No, because dad wants a trading partner in the next village or any number of things, and they're pledged. And 10, 12, 14 years later, they may meet for the first time the day of their wedding. The 6-year-old boy and 6-year-old girl. Now, what's the chance the day they meet that they both go, yeah, that's what I wanted? The answer to that's very little, because she grew up in a village where there was some little boy. She always wished things would twist and turn. She'd like to marry that little boy, but she's not pledged to him. And what's the chance that he grew up and is always hoping there's some little girl he knew, but he's not pledged to her? They show up and they're doing this really awkward, what did you say your name was? You know, kind of thing on the day of their marriage. They're married, and they go home together, and they don't have common interest. They don't have a background of anything together. I mean, you just go through all the stuff. You can imagine what would happen in our culture if I said, we're having a drawing today, and I'm going to pick one guy and one gal, and we're going to marry you and send you out of here. You know, good luck with life, you know. I mean, wish you well, you know. Put your name in the drawing, and we'll pull you out. Nobody wants that. How can they make it? How they make it is pretty simple. It's not complex. You see, she's raised her entire life. Here's 30, 40, 50, 60 things that a good wife will do for a husband, any husband. He's raised, here's 30, 40, 60 things that a good husband will do for a wife, any wife. And yes, they're disappointed the day that they meet. He wanted a soft-spoken woman, but she sounds like Roseanne Barr. She wanted a Tom Cruise-looking guy, and she got Don Knotts. I mean, seriously, they're disappointed that day. But here's what they both of them had. The day of, or the day before their wedding, their grandparents would have taken the boy aside and put their arms around their boy, and grandpa and grandma and mom and dad would have said, sweetheart, we know you don't love her, but you love us. You love us. Don't bring embarrassment on the family name. For the sake of the family, out of your love for us, go home and be a good husband to this woman. We know you don't love her. We don't know what she'll turn out to be. She may turn out to be a Jezebel. We don't know what it'll be. But out of love for us, would you go home and treat her right? And this boy begins to cry a little bit, even in an Oriental culture, and he holds his grandfather's hands and says, Grandpa, I will never embarrass you. I won't embarrass the family name. I will be a good husband to her. And the wife, the girl, she's taken aside and said, we don't know what he'll be like. He may be wonderful. We don't know. He comes from a good family, but we don't know. We know you don't love him, but you love us. Out of love for us, please go home and be a good wife to this man. Please don't dishonor our name. And she cries with her grandparents and says, out of love for you, I'll go home and be a good wife. And the two go home. And it doesn't happen the same day, it doesn't happen the same week, but they're both gritting their teeth and reaching in their character, and they're both living out what is just kindness and compassion and investment in one another out of their character. But it happens one morning, and he looks up across the table, and there's a deep, deep affection for this woman. And he cannot imagine where that affection came from, but he can't imagine living without this woman. And she looks up one morning, and he's not exactly what she would have chosen, but she can't imagine replacing him for anybody else because her affection is deep and genuine. Because the biblical principle of where your investment is, there will your heart be also. Well, if I can borrow, just to close this out for till tonight, it is the exact parallel in the Christian life. Your marriage is not yours. It never was yours. Your marriage is always something God calls as His possession. So what happens is this, that ultimately a man stands here and he holds a girl's hands and he says, Heavenly Father, I think I love her, but how do you know on these things? It's so confusing. But Heavenly Father, I do know of your great love for me and I know of my love for you. And as my act of worship, I will take this woman home and I'll be your servant in her life. God, you brought her into the world and you'll take her out. But until you do, I am your man and my act of worship will be to love you by loving and looking after her. And a woman stands here and says, Heavenly Father, I think I love him, but how do you know on these things? It's so confusing. But I know, Heavenly Father, of your grace. I know of your love for me and I know of my love for you. And out of my love for you, Heavenly Father, I'll go home with this man and I will make my act of worship to look after him. And that couple will walk down the aisle. As they do so, God will nudge the angels and wink and say, watch this. Watch this. They will grow old together and they will grow more tender. And they will grow more affection. I told you the word agape meant to gut it out. Let me give you a better definition. Agape is almost always an act of worship in which somebody says, I am God's ambassador in your life for your good on His behalf as long as I live. I'm God's ambassador in your life for your good on His behalf as long as I live. And the couples in this room who come to personal wholeness Because without personal wholeness, you can't do this. You can't do this without personal wholeness. But the couples in this room who come to personal wholeness and then choose to put an investment in, you'll grow old and your kids and your grandkids will love being in your life because you figured out, as the one out of 11 that nobody else figured out, you figured out how to have a home that had joy and laughter and the right kind of tears, and it's a barrel of fun. Don't settle for anything less.